This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
On Hope 103.2, joining us, a journalist and host of a new podcast called The Wait, Nicole Kirby. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast is one that focuses on the experience of asylum seekers, refugees, particularly one story, that of Mojgan. Can you explain her story and what about it interested you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mojgan is 29 years old and she's Iranian and she lives in Indonesia as a refugee. She's been living in Indonesia for over 7 years now. She fled Iran with her family in 2013 for political reasons and was trying to get to Australia. She flew to Indonesia and then attempted to get on a boat 4 times to cross to Australia and never made it because of the boat turn back policy in place at the time. And she's been stuck in Indonesia ever since. Mm. So she's kind of living there for who knows how long in this limbo. And there are around 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers in a similar situation in Indonesia. I was working in Jakarta a couple of years ago and I met Mojgan through the course of my work in being there. And I became really interested in her and her story because I suppose in Australia I'd heard so much about boat turnbacks and refugees and asylum seekers trying to get to Australia by boat, about Manus and Nauru, but I never really knew what it was like on the other side of boat turnbacks in Indonesia, what was going on there and, you know, who'd been left behind by that policy. When I met Mojgan, she opened up this whole world to me, and it's that world that we enter in the podcast. She also kind of flipped on its head my idea of who a refugee was. Mm. She lives in a house with an Indonesian partner. He's a doctor. That she's met since being there. She's extremely articulate, very sassy, very well informed. She's a very powerful advocate for her community. And, you know, she lives a fairly middle class life. I guess I had somehow through the media picked up these ideas of refugees as being people who live in camps and are impoverished. And that's not her at all. And she's really passionate about sharing the idea that refugees come from a whole range of backgrounds and that's who they are. And I guess she is often challenged by people saying that she's not a real refugee or not a genuine refugee. And I suppose also what drew me to her story and why I wanted to work with her is she's just incredibly raw and candid, and she really peels back to a very intimate level what it's like to live in that kind of limbo.
It's a really good insight, as you've mentioned, something that sort of had you've had your own experience where you realize, oh my goodness, my assumptions of what a refugee is aren't the full picture. I think that's going to be the experience of a lot of listeners when they realize the stories of the real people behind these headlines that we do hear. You mentioned a moment ago that there's thousands of other refugees that are living in Indonesia, but is Mojgan's story indicative of what their lives are also like, or is it quite different depending on who you are living in that area within Indonesia?
Yeah, there's a wide range of people and how they live in Indonesia. Mojgan is probably not the typical case, but, you know, like who's typical, I guess. So, yeah, as I said, there are 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers in Indonesia. About two-thirds of them, so around 8,000, live in shelters. So they're in community shelters where there's a lot of restrictions. So they have curfews at night and in the morning. They can't leave the shelters, you know, during nighttime hours. They can't leave the city that they're in. You know, they can't drive a car or a motorbike. There are a lot of restrictions on their lives. Those shelters are provided by an organisation called the International Organisation for Migration, and they rely on Australian government funding. So that's something that we go into the podcast as well, what Australia's role is in all of this. There are also the other third, around 4,000 or so asylum seekers live in the community and they rely on their savings or money sent from family and friends back home. You know, and the longer that they're there, a lot of them have been there for 6, 7, 8, 9 years now, the harder that gets. So we also look at how do you survive when your money's run out, you don't have the right to work. You know, refugees and asylum seekers don't have rights in Indonesia. You can't leave the country. You're not going anywhere. Very, very few are being resettled from Indonesia. And you're in this space where you're not really allowed to have a proper life in Indonesia. So what do you do with that?
Yeah, you're hugely reliant on generosity from others, I guess.
That's right. And you know, there's a lot of incredible people who we speak to in the podcast who are have a lot of initiative and are setting up their own initiatives. So they're setting up learning centres for refugees. They're like running food donation programs and medical clinics. Wow. And Mojgan is one of those incredible people doing a lot of that work for their community.
What sort of things do you think the Australian government and Australians individually can be doing to better help resettle refugees and asylum seekers and help turn around this kind of limbo that they do seem to be in?
Well, I mean, in the recent federal budget, the Australian government reduced its refugee or its humanitarian intake by over 25%. So that's one thing that the Australian government could increase rather than decrease its refugee intake. That's one basic thing. That's not ever going to be the complete answer. Like, the answer is not for every refugee to get resettled in Australia. There are many, many, many thousands of refugees around the world, so that's just impossible. But I think, you know, one of the key things in the approach, the way that our government and the Indonesian government has approached the issue of refugees is this pushing out. So Australia has really pushed its border out back into Indonesia. You know, boat turnbacks and the policies of surveilling refugees and asylum seekers who are leaving Indonesia effectively stopped refugees and asylum seekers from getting past Indonesia and into Australia.
Mm.
And then in Indonesia, they're refusing to deal with the problem either by kind of ignoring the fact that there are these people there who need rights in order to survive. So I think Australia has invested in punitive measures to keep refugees and asylum seekers living in very poor conditions in Indonesia. Alternatively, governments could recognise the problem of displaced people around the world is massive and they won't all have places to go, but rather than keeping them in abject conditions, we could invest in solutions like education, or rather than, you know, Australia played an active role in investing in keeping refugees and asylum seekers in immigration detention centres for almost 20 years in Indonesia. Instead of policies like that, Australia could look at, well, how do we provide education? How do we help the Indonesian government think about work rights for these people while they're there so that they can support themselves? So I think that there are other more positive ways in which we could approach this issue.
Yeah, yeah. Just in those handful that you've presented there, there is so much scope and so much possibility around what we could be doing. And I'm imagining that COVID has had a massive impact on the experience of refugees and then also what happens to those that are in, again, a space of limbo, wanting to leave a country but they can't leave, and then obviously there's all of the different restrictions around travel, etc. What's your perception on the impact of COVID on asylum seekers?
Well, yeah, I mean, resettlements have frozen because obviously so many border restrictions are in place. Also for refugees and asylum seekers who are in countries like Indonesia, but not only, I mean, also who are in Bangladesh, in Malaysia, you know, a lot of them are living in overcrowded conditions. So the shelters that I mentioned, the 8,000 refugees and asylum seekers are living in Indonesia, they're very densely packed. You know, you'll have 8 people in a room sleeping in bunk beds. So when COVID broke out, I visited a lot of those places last year. Mm. When COVID broke out, I was just terrified for the people living in there because, you know, one shelter in particular that I visited, there's 230 men living in these dorm rooms. Wow. With, yeah, 8 people to a room. If there was one case of COVID in that accommodation, it would spread like wildfire and, you know, those couple of hundred men would have it immediately. There's also very little testing going on. They're living, you know, on the poverty line, so even getting things like masks and hand sanitizer is really difficult for those men. That's just one shelter, but that's essentially a situation that a lot of asylum seekers and refugees in Indonesia and globally are experiencing at the moment.
Yeah, and because of the COVID crisis, this issue and so many others have taken a back seat. There's just not, you know, enough headlines to go around in some respects. Do you think the crisis is influencing people's views on the refugee and asylum seeker debate?
I think, as you say, it's sort of crowded it out. Like, we haven't really heard very much about refugees and asylum seekers recently because we've heard so much about COVID. Beyond that, I don't know. I guess it's hard for me to know how it's impacting people's views. I suppose we wanted to release this podcast at this moment because I feel like the situation for refugees and asylum seekers is almost completely unknown in Australia, even though we do, you know, refugees have been like a hot button issue for so many years. Somehow we've managed to completely overlook what's happening for refugees and asylum seekers in Indonesia, even though it's directly connected to Australia's border policy in a very clear way.
Yeah,
no, and now seems as good a time as any, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it really timely. And I think, like, part of my thinking around, I guess, that kind of the kind of question of, you know, why now and whether it's impacting people's thinking is because when we look at how the world will reopen and the sort of quote unquote dangers around our borders, I wonder if people are going to be a little bit more hesitant to welcome in people coming from all different places trying to seek asylum in our country. Do you think that would be an issue?
Yeah, I mean, we did have that issue earlier in the year with Christina Keneally raising those issues even around migrant workers, didn't we, around kind of the fear of migrants taking jobs if they were to come in. So, yeah, perhaps you're right. This era might see a greater kind of level of fear increased and a bolstering of, like, borders and who's in and who's out. I think that would be a real shame because I guess the people who are fleeing persecution are still fleeing persecution regardless of COVID or not. And you know, we've got a lot to benefit and gain from those people as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. But in creating the podcast, what have been your biggest takeaways being firsthand, right in the midst, or seeing firsthand, I should say, right in the midst of stories like Mojgan's and others? What's been your biggest takeaway from creating the series?
It's been really great to work with Mojgan in this podcast. So we've known each other for 3 years and we've worked together on this project for 2 years. And Mojgan's really been in control of telling her own story in this process. And we've developed a friendship. I've seen her in her moments of deepest despair and also highs or just the mundane everyday reality. And I guess it's been really important to me that she's taken an active role in this. It's been really good to be able to facilitate her voice and her getting her own story out on her own terms. And that story is one of waiting, you know, like she's stuck there waiting for who knows how long. And so it's sort of like, what do you do with that wait? She's incredibly resilient and strong, but you know, there are moments we talk about her faith and we talk about the role of faith in people surviving this like incredibly grueling experience. And for some people, faith is what gets them through every single day.
Mm.
And for Mojgan, it's really challenged her faith. One of the biggest take-homes is kind of like deep diving, like into the everyday experience and the psychological experience of what it's like to be caught in limbo. And we also join the dots with like the bigger political picture. You know, how is it that this bigger political picture creates this situation where people are left stranded on the borderline? It's confronting to look at this situation, but I suppose we're also trying to draw the dots and show how we are all connected.
And I suppose you're prompting people to ask some of those bigger questions themselves as they listen and as they try to reconcile some of the everyday realities with the big picture side of what's going on. But Nicole, I so appreciate you taking the time and committing to those many years of putting this together along with Mojgan and all of the sort of people involved. And thank you for sharing your time with us to talk about it today.
It's my pleasure. And so if listeners want to find The Wait, they can go to our website, which is theweightpodcast.com. Or they can search iTunes or Spotify or wherever they get their podcasts.
Fantastic, Nicole. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.